The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to this very special Thursday morning Space Show program. Thank you all for tuning in. A couple of very quick, very fast announcements. First of all, the toll-free number you can call in about 15 minutes when we open it, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let it ring until we can answer it, then be patient until we can bring you up on the air. Chat, for those of you wanting to use Instant Messenger, ICQ, or CompuServe, all one word, Space Show Chat. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, dmlivings@yahoo.com, and thespaceshow@gmail.com. Then, remember, the Space Show is a trademark and registered service mark for me, Dr. David Livingston. I also have the copyright on it, which means that you can do pretty much anything you want with our program, except anything commercial, nor can you edit or play with the dialogue, the text, or the comments of the guest or me during a Space Show program. But you're certainly welcome to burn them to CD, share them with your friends, anything that will make listening to the programs more convenient. And then a special thanks to Andrew and Gigadial for their great podcasting service. The RSS URL is on my website and both newsletters for you to subscribe to it if you want to use podcasting. Check out our newsletter at thespaceshow.com. All the events for the coming weeks and into the coming months are posted there. The newsletter is uploaded every Monday and changed during the week as necessary. If you want the short email version, send an email to the Dr. Space address. Visit the Space Show store when you have a chance and click on the Support the Space Show button. Your help is really important to us, and we thank you for it. Then again, remember, hold these two dates for two great space conferences, May 4th through May 7th, the 25th Annual International Space Development Conference put on by the National Space Society. That's going to be in Los Angeles. And the Mars Society Conference, August 3rd through 6th, to be put on in Washington, D.C. Visit both of these organizations' websites. You can already register at special pre-registration rates for these conferences. Well, our guest today is going to be Richard C. Hoagland, and I'm going to introduce him in a few minutes. But we have a great surprise guest with us to lead us off, and really fun way to start off 2006. Our guest is Dr. Robin Falkov. Robin, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm fine, David. Thank you so much. And a very happy new year to you and all of your listeners from Enterprise and from myself.
Well, thank you. The last time you were on, we sat here and we watched the vote on CAFTA go down.
That was a memorable experience.
That's right. Is it too soon to know what the results of that vote and policy are?
Well, unfortunately, CAFTA was passed, and the backstory from many different sources was that there was a lot of arm twisting, a lot of pressure on the congressmen that they had to vote to support it if they wanted their highway and transportation bills to go through. And lo and behold, what do we have just a few days later? This big announcement, I think it was, I'm not 100% sure right now because it's something I want to forget, but I think it was about a couple of billion dollars that was approved for all these road improvements, simple little things that were not of the utmost necessity.
Well, politics as usual.
Yes, strange bedfellows, right?
You know, absolutely. you know, prescription drugs get a lot of news, you know, lately with the lawsuits against Vioxx coming down and, you know, other, and then we see stem cell research fraud coming from the greatest stem cell researcher in Korea.
Yes.
What is your take on all of this? I mean, we're all probably on lots of prescription drugs, especially as we get older. Ian, have any words of advice or any good guidance for us all?
Yes, I definitely do, and this is why I'm doing the workshop that I will be doing in L.A., so people can understand what to do and be more effective when they have to deal with different healthcare practitioners.
And make sure you tell us about the workshop, too.
Sure. That's at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles, Valentine's Day weekend, the 10th through the 12th. I will be speaking at 10 a.m., Saturday morning, and I will discuss how people can use the physician's desk reference, how they can use medical dictionaries, keeping a diary, what to do. But from what you initially asked me, David, I've been watching this for the past, oh gosh, I shouldn't say it, over 20 years. Let's leave it at that. I've read articles about cover-ups and lying in medical research. Mother Jones did big exposés about sumatriptan, a migraine formula causing heart problems. The lists go on and on. So where does that leave people? That leaves them having to pay attention, which they don't want to do. But there's nothing more important than your health. So there are tools that can be used. You can be effective. Your listeners have Google. I mean, what does it take to type something in? Read the warnings, read the side effects, and communicate with your physician.
How do you know when you Google in something about medicine, and there's a million sites for every subject, it seems like. How can the average person recognize BS from something that's credible?
Well, a lot of times it's from the pharmaceutical company, and they have to make available the information. So what people need to do is read the warnings and contraindications. You don't need the technical pharmacology of a medication. That's not going to be what you'll be recognizing if you have any symptoms of a side effect. So you can narrow the field down. That's what I try to do with my patients, narrow the field down so they know what to look for and how to communicate it.
All right, well, you talk about communicating with doctors. I take a statin drug, and from my knowledge with you, I load up on CoQ10.
Good.
And every time I go to any host of doctors that I see from time to time, they tell me nonsense, and there's not even an opportunity to communicate with them about the subject, and they will pull out the PDR, and it says, see, there's nothing in here that says you need to take CoQ10 with that.
Okay, well, you know, well, those studies were covered up, okay, and you can find that research online and print it out and bring it with you to your doctor. But using the PDR as an explanation for why something is not necessary, one needs to realize that every single medication in the PDR, the pharmaceutical companies pay to be there.
Whoa. They pay to have their drug listed?
They pay to be listed in the physician's desk reference. Okay? But by law, they still have to tell you down to that .0 of what's wrong. You know, what is that remote side effect that, you know, you're going to have the possible experience, because it has for them to include it, which goes back putting the responsibility on the patients. You've got to report what you're feeling. And if you have some condescending physician that talks down to you, oh dear, you know, this must be some kind of emotional problem you're having, it's time to change doctors. What people forget is that you're paying the bill. You, your insurance company, you know, it still is up to you. And if everybody rolls over and takes it, then nothing's going to change.
Well, Robin, I pay the salaries indirectly through my taxes of JPL and NASA people, and I ask them why they won't plan a Cydonia mission with humans on it, and they give me the finger. So do they learn from the pharmaceuticals and the doctors?
Excuse me?
Do they learn this from the pharmaceuticals and the doctors?
It's across the board. It's how much can we dump on people and how much will they take? And once they start screaming and complaining, then changes happen.
Amazing, because it really is frustrating. And I just wrote a chapter in a book about this. And, you know, said one of the problems that turns people off from space so much is that they get dissed from the scientists. They're told they're not important. The only thing that counts is what a scientist believes it should count. And, you know, I'm not talking about going against the scientific method, but my God, pay attention to the people who make your life and your career possible.
Definitely. And what more effective tool to discredit information than ridicule? You know, you have a society where people are terrified of being thought foolish.
You know, I did a program last week with a doctor, William Rowe. I don't know if you're familiar with him. His work,
I can't say that I am, no.
Okay, his work is about why women are physiologically better suited to be in space for long-term missions than men. But one of the things he started talking about was the ineffectiveness of pharmaceuticals in space because of malabsorption due to microgravity and the very shortened life of pharmaceuticals because of enhanced radiation. And he talked about how
fascinating.
Yeah, how astronauts and people, they don't normally rely on taking medication by mouth if they need it. They're going to get it injected or take it sublingually or something like that.
Oh, almost homeopathic, huh?
Do you know anything about this? I mean, I've had a lot of space medicine doctors on who, you know, never have mentioned this before, and I thought that was really interesting.
No, I am not familiar with this, and I think it's a fascinating area that you're bringing up, and it's something that I would like to learn more about. So I will look into that.
Yeah, his website is really a weird website, FEMS, F-E-M-S, in space, .com.
Oh,
so knowing the way I am, I was immediately attracted to this site. I thought it was going to be something completely different.
You read my mind, David.
Well, because you guys know me too well.
Yes.
And in fact, that is why Dr. Rowe was called to my attention. People kept sending me this website and said, you got to check it out. But he's a pretty creative, interesting internal medicine doctor. And it was a really fascinating program, and you can hear what he has to say on archives from last week. And,
oh, it was last week. I'll listen to that, definitely.
Yeah, and if you ever want to contact him, let me know, and I'll put you in touch with him.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I can think of a couple of things right away, but I'd be very interested in reviewing what he's found, because that's a whole other set of problems.
I know Richard will talk about all of this, but what do you see as new for Enterprise for 2006?
David, he has been up so late every night or every morning. There's new information. There's groundbreaking information, and I'll probably get whacked if I break this. But there are some new images that Richard has been working on and sharing amongst the, you know, other Enterprise members.
Uh-huh.
And when this comes out, people will be kind of shocked. I got to see a little bit of it, and I can't really say much, but it's out of this world.
Is it on the Web Enterprise site yet?
Oh, no. This is not on the site yet, and I think Richard is making his way to give you guys a little more information. Maybe he'll share some details and not just tease, but this is his baby at the moment, and it is very exciting stuff.
Well, I want to hear Richard's role in the history of developing alternative space. I mean, I was shocked when I did a program recently and they talked about the Harvest Moon, for example, and I just happened to mention it in passing to Richard, and he said, that was my program. I did it. And the guest didn't talk about Richard, didn't mention it. It was a history that simply was not lost, and I said, Richard, let's get back together and talk about your contributions to alt space.
And it was great talking with you and your audience.
Thank you, Robin, and Happy New Year. I hope I get to see you guys in New Mexico soon somehow. So
we hope so, too. Happy New Year to you.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Good morning, David.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Well, I'm up. You know, this reminds me of those old Edward R. Burrow programs. You were there.
Right.
Where he would bring camera crew. And, of course, in those days, it wasn't little tiny portable minicams. You had to bring, you know, an entire television studio. And you had guests sitting there, you know, with their kids, you know, all dressed up in their Sunday best, looking as if he had just happened to drop in for breakfast. And it was incredibly staged. But this morning, you dropped in before breakfast, so everyone has gotten a view of what things are like in New Mexico when I'm not on the air in the middle of the night.
Well, Richard, you know, to lead off the discussion, I mean, I was really stunned when I mentioned to you in passing that I had a guest on that was talking about Harvest Moon, and all of a sudden you dropped it on me that, hey, this was your project, and it wasn't told that it was your project, and you've had a role that goes back into alt space, but this is a history that's not getting out there.
Well, you know, I didn't get on this subject just because I had nothing better to do. I have a very long history. Some of it is publicly chronicled. Some of it has not been told. Some of it, you know, it's the kind of thing where unless someone asks, you don't really volunteer it because it's not relevant to what's going on right now. But when I did hear that you had a guest that had talked about one of my babies in the pre-Sidonia era.
And a cool baby at that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there had been a group of us, a small group, for probably 20, 30 years, who have been trying to jumpstart an alternative space program to the official NASA line, even before I got into the areas of political controversy where it looks as if NASA has been sitting on a lot of data that a lot of folks are not aware of. And we have tried in these previous years many different ways and in many different venues to get the private enterprise system, that incredible engine of production that, you know, the United States is renowned for around the world, which it essentially invented, off this planet and into space so that we could make space available and the benefits of space available for an awful lot of people, not just here at home, but all around the globe. And, you know, you and I have discussed over the years tangentially a couple of these activities, but when I sat down the other day in preparation for this show, which, as you said, was because you were kind of astonished that I had been involved in this other project and no one had mentioned it.
Well, but equally astonished that the guest didn't mention it. I mean, that just blew me away.
Well, you know, what is it that they say, failure is an orphan and success has a thousand fathers?
Right.
If things don't work, no one wants to be associated with them. If you come up with a really cool idea and you put a lot of effort into it and someone else puts up, you know, the money, the folks who put up the money tend to kind of believe that they own the idea. And, you know, it's situation normal. For those that may not know what we're talking about Project Harvest Moon, which is something that I came up with as part of the beginnings of the alternate space community, the grassroots space community, the space activism movement back in the early 70s when it was obvious that Apollo was winding down and that the American people's interest was drifting, and we were looking, a group of us, for ways that we could combat that and actually bring home the idea that you could make money in space, because in this culture, unless you can make money on something, it eventually will peter out. And although I am firmly behind the government efforts to open the space frontier, you know, given the historical legacy of other frontiers that the government has helped open, but then has stepped aside for private enterprise, and I'm thinking in particular the railroads. You know, it was once said that, you know, before the railroads, the United States was impossible, and after the invention of the railroads, it was inevitable.
Right.
We felt, a number of us, that space was in the same boat, using a kind of a generous pun there, that unless we could invent a mechanism analogous to the railroads and the robber barons of the 19th century, where a lot of ordinary folks could benefit from access to space and the riches that are out there and the products and the materials and the, you know, visionary things that can be done in space, that can only be done in space, it would never get beyond a small government effort, because the actual NASA effort, as you know, has always hovered at around the 1% level of federal expenditures. I mean, people look at NASA and some of the critics say, oh, my God, you're wasting all that money. Well, frankly, NASA has nothing of the federal budget compared to defense or Social Security or the entitlements programs or things like that. And what we wanted to do was to create something that would give people the idea, hey, wait a minute, as an ordinary American, as an ordinary businessman, I can actually make money on the high frontier, and that's why I came up with this thing called Harvest Moon.
And it was a great program where you're going to buy a Saturn V to go to the moon, right?
What we were doing, we were talking with people like Tom Paine, who was the head of NASA at that time, and Wernher von Braun. I mean, I actually got to meet von Braun as part of this. And I even got to meet a guy named Winston, who is a gem dealer, a diamond merchant, on Fifth Avenue in downtown New York.
Harry Winston.
And, you know, when I went up to Winston's to have the meeting with him, and I'll tell you about why we do that in a minute, what struck me, you know, in retrospect years later, was going into Harry Winston's was a bit like the opening of that scene in Get Smart.
Uh-huh.
With all those doors and all the locks and all the, you know, the huge barricades and all those incredible steel, you know, things that they closed behind him.
Right.
Because, of course, this was a diamond merchant, world class, in the middle of downtown New York, and he had lots and lots of diamonds lying around in his office, and they were all in these huge vaults, and I never saw so many doors or heard so many steel locks clang in my entire life. Well, the reason we had gone to Winston, Harry Winston, is because if you're going to do a private mission to the moon, which is what our scenario involved, it basically involved private entrepreneurs buying from the federal government a Saturn V, complete with Apollo and service modules, Apollo Command and service modules, the lunar module, spacesuits, the whole nine yards, except it would be done privately, and the idea would be that they would invest in this mission, which in those days cost, I think it was about $500 million to launch a Saturn V. And if you went to the moon as a private mission, you had to obviously have a product that you could bring back and sell to people. Well, I had noticed, because of my position as a science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, on the previous missions, particularly Apollo 11, where I actually got to stand in one of our studios with Walter Schirra and Paul Gast and some other people from Houston and hold pieces of the moon that Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong had brought back. I mean, that, David, was the most incredible moment, I think, of my life, certainly up until that point, to be holding pieces. We were standing in a little circle, and Walter Cronkite was there too, of course, and we were all passed around this little vial, and Paul Gast, who was the expert from the Johnson Space Center, the lunar expert, had brought up these little samples of the moon to show people on our network air on CBS. So we were standing around this little, I mean, it almost was like one of those New Age ceremonial circles. And it was Cronkite and Schirra and myself and our executive producer and Paul and a couple other people. And we passed these samples of the moon around, and we each held them in the palm of our hand for, you know, a minute or so. And it was an extraordinarily spiritual moment. I mean, there's only one way to describe it. It was a spiritual moment. And I realized in my conversations with Paul that as part of the moon's surface, as part of the regolith, part of the soil on the moon, the astronauts had found these little tiny slivers of glass that were called spherules, that were basically a few millimeters across. Some of them were bigger, some of them smaller. And they had various colors because they had been doped with various metals in the process of formation in the airless vacuum of the lunar surface. When the standard model was that when meteorites hit the moon, it generates a lot of heat. And the heat and the ejecta is sprayed out in a pattern, and the stuff falls back to the moon's surface. Well, in that ballistic flight, as the ejecta is flying out, it goes from a melt where it's molten to where it's solid, where it cools quickly in the vacuum in that ballistic arc, and it forms in zero G spherical particles, little melted particles of glass. And so I realized that if you could pick up enough of these and bring them back, they would be more valuable than diamonds, carat for carat. And that's what we went to Harry Winston as part of this project to check out. And when we laid out the whole scenario and told him, you know, how these things are formed and how rare they are and how there'd only be, you know, maybe a couple hundred pounds ever on Earth, He said, my God, you're right. They'd be maybe 10 times more valuable than diamonds. Well, if you do the numbers, it turns out that with a few hundred pounds, you could pay for a Saturn V mission to the moon. And that's what we created as part of this discussion with the high-level brass at NASA and some people at Commerce. And it was Barbara Marx Hubbard and Earl Hubbard who were the springboards to this, because they had created a foundation that was trying to do space activism in the early 70s. And I have been introduced to them through my executive producer at Special Events at CBS, Bob Wechsler. And so when we were looking, you know, for some way to basically keep the space program going, because it was obvious that there'd be no Apollos 18 or 19 or 20, that it was going to be cut off at Apollo 17, we came up with this, I came up with this idea, why don't we try a private enterprise mission? And everything worked up until the point where it looked like we might have some actual potential investors, because, you know, private investors could have made a lot of money. You know, I mean, oil companies literally deal in the billions of dollars. Well, this was of the level of a major oil expedition, except it was using tried and true American hardware, tried and true American astronauts. It would have obviously sent us to another place on the moon. It would have given us some new science, but it would have demonstrated at a very high visibility in the very beginnings of that transition between the government effort and the private effort, which has to come, David, as you and I totally agree. It would have demonstrated that, yes, there is money to be made in them, our lunar hills, and anybody with an ante can get in the game and play and be part of the new and high frontier.
So von Braun approved it. Where did it go wrong?
We never did find out. It suddenly, there was a chill that descended on the conversations, and Tom Paine kind of wandered away and said it wasn't going to be feasible. And, of course, from my hindsight now, 30-some years later, knowing what NASA has been hiding, the last thing they wanted us to have access to was the moon, with private investors who would have a say in what they got when the astronauts got back and the photographs got back and all that. And in fact, it seems to me it died because of the politics of what NASA has been hiding on the moon that I've been talking about and working on for the last 20 or so years. But at the moment, we were incredibly naive, incredibly hopeful, incredibly inspired, and we got a lot of people very excited. And it's a shame that it never went anywhere, because it would have demonstrated visibly, brilliantly, in a very easy manner that, yes, you can make money in space. Now, you and I talked the other day about resurrecting Harvest Moon and doing it with robotics. Even without, you know, President Bush's new vision and NASA Administrator Griffin's, you know, follow-up with basically Apollo 2, with people like David Gump or David Hudson or others, if we created the right robotic technology, which is now essentially off the shelf, and we're able to buy a cheap booster from the Soviets or, you know, God bless them, even the Chinese, anybody now could do what we had proposed back in the early 70s, robotically, bring the stuff back and sell it on the diamond market as a way of demonstrating, yes, there is money to be made in space, and particularly on the lunar surface.
I was involved a couple of years ago with a company who had a lunar retriever business plan model, and they could not price it out to show a return on investment using a Delta rocket. So clearly, and there were some issues in
product.
Well, there were some issues in their business plan too.
Okay.
The company doesn't exist anymore, and I would think a lot of the expenses could have been eliminated if it was a more focused type of plan and it wasn't going to be something in perpetuity that had to keep being financed by the next round of investors.
The pyramid scheme.
Well, you know, they were ethical and they had integrity, but the reality was, as long as you could get new investors for the next mission, you could keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they set out to be that, but that's the way it was shaping up. And of course, it never got any place. The investment community really wasn't ripe. And then 9/11 happened, and you know, nothing was ripe for that at that time. But clearly, you could get there with robotics, and you could do this. You could possibly even do it with one of Elon's rockets if he gets Falcon flying and then can get the Falcon 5 or 9 flying. That would be a pretty low-cost way to get there with robotics, and you wouldn't have an ITAR problem. So I think it's a great idea.
Given that in the same time frame, the Russians demonstrated the Lunokhod missions, which is, for those who may not remember, was an unmanned robotic mission to the moon. Russians sent it up, I believe, on a Proton, and they basically did telerobotics. In other words, the robot didn't have a smart computer because of the second and a half lag time for radio signals between Earth and moon. It was driven from a control center outside Moscow by radio signals with people on the ground. And they were able to collect lunar samples. They wandered around with this kind of bathtub-shaped little robot with wheels. They drilled down. They picked up core samples. They put them in a canister. They sealed the canister. They fired off the canister on a return trajectory to Earth. It reentered the atmosphere, probably, I think, over the Indian Ocean is where they used to come in. They picked it up with a ship at sea, and they brought it back to Moscow, and they uncrated it. And, you know, began analyzing the samples, all without human beings involved except via remote control. Now, that was in 1971. The technology of robotics now is so mature. Look at how Spirit and Opportunity have been functioning, you know, 2 years now on the Martian surface. That it seems to me almost axiomatic that if some group of private individuals really interested in jump-starting the high frontier and demonstrating people can make money, not with communication satellites, but with real tangible stuff in space, a mission to go to the moon to harvest spherules and bring them back and sell them to people on Rodeo Drive would be a very, very elegant way to demonstrate that and would be a heck of a lot of fun.
You know, you were involved in the early days of Alt Space, and we talk about it a lot on this show. And it seems like so much of Alt Space is devoted right now to trying to do policy or get legislation passed. The companies that are trying to do something basically, for the most part, get funded by the government because there isn't any way that they're making money on their own. And when Gary Hudson was a guest a couple of months ago, he said they had to have government money to survive. How do you see things having changed, or have they? In we're talking about the 70s with Harvest Moon, and now we're at 2005, and we're still no place, Richard.
Well, the analogy that we always look to was the way the airlines, and to a lesser extent the railroads, became the transportation giants that they are today. Certainly the airlines and the railroads to a lesser degree. They started out with government subsidies. The government subsidies to the railroads were basically the right-of-ways and the land, because of the government land that was, you know, clear out west. You know, if you ignore a few pesky Indians, I'm obviously being bitterly ironic there.
Right.
The major subsidy of the federal government, and when the railroads that knit this country together and created the economic behemoth that is the United States today, came because the government was able to supply the land on which the railroads were built. The airline industry, if you remember back, anybody, did you see the Howard Hughes film?
Sure.
Okay.
The Aviator.
For the folks that saw The Aviator, there's a very good historical reprise of how the feds got involved in helping to create, you know, the vast airline industry with the help of some extraordinary entrepreneurs like Howard Hughes. And they basically did it by subsidizing airlines via the mail. The U.S. Post Office had a, you know, congressionally mandated mission to deliver the mail, you know, rain, sleet, et cetera, that wonderful, you know, phrase. And to do it between towns farther apart that a truck could drive, you had to put it in an airplane. Somebody realized at some point back in the teens or 20s, I guess, and fly it between cities or fly it coast to coast. Well, a lot of incredibly daring guys, pilots, lost their lives flying in biplanes the U.S. mail, you know, around this country. But it was the government input in terms of you know, subsidy. in terms of standards, in terms of safety, in terms of engines and airframes and all that, to basically make the mail delivery reliable, that created the foundation and the framework for a private industry that would ferry, you know, grandma used to be able to pass what my friend Harry Stein called the Stein grandmother test, where his grandmother could get into the transportation, didn't have to ask, you know, who was driving, and she got where she was going. And it was that subsidy which then got out of the way and allowed the private entrepreneurship to take over and enterprise to take over and create the commerce and the transportation networks that we benefit from, you know, in the beginning years of the 21st century. Well, that logical development, David, for some reason, has not happened in space. And in 2001, I wrote a piece, you know, based on, you know, the vision of my dear friend Arthur C. Clarke. Why hasn't 2001 arrived with, you know, the Hilton in orbit and the Pan Am ferry and all these, you know, the moon base at Tycho and, or not Tycho, the Clavius. And all, in other words, why was the 21st century space vision exemplified in Stanley and Arthur's movie stillborn? Why did it not happen? And until the alternate space community directly addresses that crucial question, I don't think, Richard Branson notwithstanding, you know, and Dick Rattan, or Bert Rattan, that we're going to make any real progress.
They say, you know, because I talk to all these guys, I'm part of that community, they're on the show all the time, they say they lost interest, the moon program got boring, Vietnam was a distraction, the Great Society with LBJ was a distraction, we couldn't afford it, and you know, nobody wanted to tune in to see a bunch of astronauts walking around basically doing nothing on the moon anymore. And, you know, the ability for NASA to market with excitement and creativity is non-existent. And that was clearly evident toward the end of Apollo when the newness of the Apollo missions had worn off. And the rest is, you know, downhill fast when all you do is go 300 miles up and go around and around in a circle. And you don't do the exciting things or fulfill the dreams and promises that people were led to believe the space program was all about. We were, you know, the L5ers had vision, and nothing ever materialized from that. The rest is history. So now you've got the alt space leaders and the community trying to fight back with cheap access to space, mostly suborbital. A few are contracting and trying to play a role with the Return to the Moon program, whether NASA will give them a fair chance or give them serious funding. I guess it depends on a lot of different things. But the American people are still not grabbing the program because it doesn't speak to them.
Well, part of it, you know, again, it goes back to an appropriate analysis. And I've heard all the arguments that Vietnam was going on. I mean, look, the American industry for aviation was born in the throes of World War One. We were fighting our first world war. We were a relatively poor country. And at the same time that we were doing that, we developed an incredibly robust aircraft industry. You know, when you look at the time span between Lindbergh, which was, what, 1927?
Right.
And the first moon rocket, which was, if you want to count Apollo 8, that was 68. There is more time that has elapsed between the footsteps of Neil Armstrong on the lunar surface and now, with nothing happening in space, private, really private, you know, development, compared to the airline industry of the 1920s and 1930s. So what I'm saying, and I've been saying this for many, many years to everybody who would listen, ranging from Jerry Pournelle, who was one of the key voices back in the 70s in the entrepreneurial alternate space, you know, scene.
Right.
To people like Bob Heinlein, who kind of wrote the book. Remember The Man Who Sold the Moon?
Absolutely.
That was our Bible. That was what we, you know, I brought it out and I showed Barbara in her room. I said, this is how we can do this. And they, you know, jumped up and said, oh my God, you know, this sounds really cool. And we went and did what I said we did in Harvest Moon a few minutes ago. But nothing has happened because, for one thing, as I've discovered, the politics, even at the overt level, vis-a-vis NASA and private enterprise in space, has been extremely chilly. NASA has done everything they could to keep entrepreneurs out of space.
Yeah, yeah. You'd not get an argument from me on that.
Well, but we can maybe argue about the reason. Everybody says it's because they wanted to be the 800-pound gorilla. And my feeling now, having worked on, you know, the projects that I worked on and found the things on the NASA data sets that we found and found the cover-ups and found what they're hiding, the fact is that there was a quiet government edict that went out vis-a-vis NASA that nobody be privately allowed into space, certainly into deep space, because of what they would find that they could not then be censored for. You know, if you have too many people going to the moon, somebody's going to trip over the really cool stuff and, you know, blab it. And that's what they could not have. Again, this is my perspective based on my 30 years of doing this. And you can either agree with me or we can agree to disagree. But that's my position, having basically earned my wings in this alternate space community before it even had a name as alternate space. I mean, I did a lot of things, both individually and collectively with other people, in the 70s and 80s, trying to generate excitement on the part of the private sector in going into space and basically just making money. Like they make money here, why not make money up there? And we were met with interesting results, but then we were met with equally interesting or more interesting opposition that I could never put into perspective until I realized what was out there that they, meaning the NASA infrastructure, was trying to keep secret from the rest of the American people. And until the alternate space community addresses centrally, why has this model not followed the curve of the railroads or the airlines? I don't think, Elon Musk notwithstanding, or Richard Branson, that we're ever going to get beyond low Earth suborbital flights, which are safe because you're not going to see anything in a suborbital hop.
So they throw you the bone, but you don't get to the real stuff.
Yeah. And until we get to the moon with private enterprise, you know, you can't even consider that you have private enterprise in space. I mean, we have had technically private enterprise in space vis-a-vis the communication satellite industry, right?
Correct.
And it's on the downhill part of the curve. There are fewer communication satellites being launched now than there were 10 years ago. And I can tell you my take on why that is, but maybe you should tell me why you think that is.
Well, the only take I have on that is the official, you know, marketing and business and industry stats that talk about demand curves and launch cost and what's needed versus what's already there and frequency allocation and growth in the marketplace and growth in the population centers. So, you know, all of that makes sense if you're not willing to look any deeper. And so, you know, the issue, I guess, is for people, how deep does one want to pursue why a market is changing and why it's changing downward when one would think that the uses for communications in space might be a lot greater than what they were 10 years ago. I do know the satellites do a lot more per satellite unit than they used to, and that may play a role in it. But I think one would have to look really deep to see what happens in the process rather than just take industry stats as an answer to the question you just raised. What is your take?
Important question, because that area of space is the most productive. It's making somebody a lot of money, right?
Enormous amounts, yes.
Yeah.
At the high launch costs, by the way.
At high launch costs. But what's interesting is that unlike the normal business models that I'm familiar with, where on Earth, if you're doing something and it's expensive and you want to do more of it because you can make money doing it and there's a demand, you know, there's a market for it, there is a real pressure to lower costs, particularly technological costs. For some reason, the space business seems to be exempt from the normal pressures of normal business. And no one has put dedicated effort, either public or private, into lowering the launch technology costs since I was trying to gin up alternate space back in the hoary days of the 1970s. And that, again, flies against the Lindbergh model, where the cost of airplanes, the cost of making them, of flying them, of, you know, fueling them, of landing them, of creating airports and all that. It went down, 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 which is the only reason we have a commercial aircraft industry. If it had stayed at the level that it started, you know, you and I would be walking between here and San Francisco, and we certainly wouldn't be getting on a 747.
Well, I can play the devil's advocate with you and give you the industry responses to this, and that is that it's extremely hard to work with the rocket equation and come up with ways to lower space access costs by magnitudes using chemical rockets. And certainly all space companies are trying to do this. Elon Musk is one example, and it is really hard for him. He has not yet flown, and every time he gets ready to fly, another problem or something happens, and he has to delay for a month or two to fix something.
Mm-hmm.
So we know it's not easy, and we know it's not cheap. When I ask people at Boeing and Lockheed why they haven't found a way to make significant improvements in launch cost and deal with the physics of the rocket equation, either by having a better type of fuel or something that could make the difference, they say they're working at it, but it's extremely hard. It's really, you know, challenging, and they say it's not that they're not trying to do it, that it's really hard to bend the laws of the physics of the rocket equation. And they're stuck with chemical rockets, and the only viable alternative to chemical rockets is space elevator, and that is so far off in the future that we can't even talk about it right now. The materials don't even exist. And then if you bring up anti-gravity, they mostly laugh at it and scoff at it and say, no, not doesn't count, it's not there, unless, you know, the black ops are doing something, but it isn't filtered into the marketplace. And then when you say we're being prevented, say, from going to the moon or something, they say, well, wait a minute, there are private sector companies that are getting ready to go to the moon. Transorbital is one, if they ever do it. But what are the Chinese going to find when they go to the moon? And will they keep their mouths shut if they find things on the moon that, you know, one thinks should be not disclosed? What if the Japanese get to the moon? Are they going to keep their mouths shut? What if a private sector company does manage to get to the moon in 2010? You know, NASA's going to have a lot to answer for if some of this stuff gets, you know, revealed to the world. So how does NASA deal with all this?
Well, when I look at the landscape and I hear the conversations that I participated in 30 years ago. I mean, David, 30 years out of a man's life is a reasonable chunk of time, would you not say?
Yeah, it's probably the half of the productive life.
That represents literally the span between Lindbergh and Neil's boot prints on the moon. That's what we did in the aircraft industry, not with government, but privately. And when I look at the space game and the fact that we have basically done nothing, we have frittered away decade after decade after decade, and we put, you know, our federal eggs all in the shuttle basket, and we all know the catastrophe that we have paid because of that awful decision. The fact is that space is not developing, did not develop along the natural expansion curves of previous transportation networks or frontiers. And until the alternate space community, my position is, until the alternate space community confronts that difference, that radical difference directly, and doesn't let, you know, Boeing say, oh, it's the rocket equation, we just can't get there, nothing is going to change. Elon Musk, you know, bless his heart, is going to be duplicating what von Braun and Goddard did, you know, well nigh on 100 years ago.
And he's making the same mistakes that they made. That is what is really interesting. When he makes a mistake and Falcon doesn't go and Elon puts it out there for the public, he's really open about it. Guys will send me emails saying this is what happened in 1966 with such and such rocket. You know, why don't they go back and learn history, you know, to avoid the mistakes? You're exactly right. History is being repeated. The wheel is being reinvented.
So then the question is, and this is going to get me a lot of friends in the alternate space community, is it all a false front Western town? Is all of this activity by these various handful of entrepreneurs who have lots and lots of money, people like Paul Allen and Elon Musk and all that, is it all just for show and nobody is really serious because they've been, and I'm going to use this term very specifically to get them mad at me so there's a conversation going, have they been bought off? Because bright people can't keep making the same dumb mistakes we keep seeing decade after decade after decade. I mean, Phil Chapman and I, and you've had Phil on
the show. Yeah, Phil's been on the show several times, uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Phil, for those who may not remember, was a scientist astronaut. I met him during the Apollo 14 mission when he and a mutual friend of ours were at the Cape, and I wound up doing an extraordinarily interesting alternate space project with him and his friend. We basically helped a very brave young lady named Sheila Scott from England fly around the world over the North Pole, all with the help of Goddard and the Landsat satellites that I was able to borrow to assist her private mission to demonstrate again an alternate use for space that people hadn't thought of in terms of search and rescue, in terms of environmental monitoring, in terms of, I mean, we did some really cool stuff vis-a-vis satellites and Sheila Scott's flight, and Phil and I, you know, Phil was kind of her official science guy, and I was an unofficial advisor because I was also advising Cronkite in those years. But the point is that Phil and I had long discussions about this, up to and including a discussion that wound up with an extraordinary demonstration, again, of what private industry could do on the moon if it just put its mind to it, called the Hammer and Feather Experiment. Remember that?
I remember I asked Phil about that with you when he was on the air one time. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, we were looking again for ways to get people excited about what you could do on the moon. And remember, Isaac Asimov had written, you know, novels and nonfiction, and Arthur Clarke had done the same about, you know, you could up to and include fly on the moon. So if you put colonies there someday, you know, human flight, human muscle-powered flight will become possible, which is something that goes back before Leonardo da Vinci. You know, that's how
right.
The concept of flight originated here. Guys standing on windswept hills, looking at the sky, looking at the birds and saying, oh my, I wish I could do that. Well, on the moon, a human being in a proper environment, with air, obviously, a dome or something, could fly. The whole Daedalus thing could come true. So we were talking about this one night, and he was telling me, Phil was, he was the science, I'm trying to remember what the title was, he was somehow formally attached to Apollo 15 as science astronaut or something like that. And he said they were looking for something to do. David Scott was looking for something to do to demonstrate the utility of the moon, the ability of the moon missions to capture the human dream and aspiration and motivate kids to want to, you know, basically go up there themselves someday and create another outpost of civilization. So we're sitting there at Goddard, you know, watching Sheila Scott's telemetry signals come back via the spacecraft. And we had long hours where we had nothing to do because we had to wait for her to check in between outposts as she flew over the North Pole. And so I limbed out for him something that I thought would be really cool. I said, why doesn't David duplicate the famous Galileo experiment? Demonstrate on the moon that heavy objects and light objects fall at exactly the same rate. And he took this to David Scott. And when Apollo 15 went to the moon in July, I believe, of 71, at the end of the EVAs, David said, now I got a little demonstration for you. And he took out a hammer, a geologist's hammer, and a falcon feather because he was Air Force and he had named his lunar module Falcon. And he dropped the hammer and the feather in the airless environment of the moon to demonstrate what the story about Galileo dropping the two, you know, balls from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa has told us all these years. And, of course, in the lunar vacuum, the two hit the surface exactly at the same moment. And that, again, came from my efforts to inspire people that the moon was a different, exotic, exciting place that we should not leave just to the government, but we should privately go and do interesting things there. Well, Phil and I used to talk about what the biggest impediment was to doing all that, and obviously it's launch costs. It's the technology we have to work with. And, you know, the alternative was that when he left the NASA program, he went to work for a guy, I think, named Kantrowitz in Boston, who was working on a private technology which would use lasers to send spacecraft into Earth orbit very, very cheaply. The idea was you basically launch on the top of a large mirror, the laser beam follows the vehicle up into orbit and is the energy source that basically vaporizes the reaction mass. I think water or some very light molecular weight fuel was to be used. You didn't have oxidation on board. It simply boiled away because of the energy of the laser beam being beamed up through steerable optics from the Earth. And when you got into orbit, obviously you can do all kinds of things. You can assemble larger spacecraft. You can send cargo up. You can send them up at very high G, which is more efficient than low G flights. In other words, this was in the 70s, David. We were talking about this kind of technology. This was before Star Wars, before the government put huge amounts of R&D money into developing super high-powered lasers, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's the equivalent of the government subsidizing the railroads by giving the railroad companies the land. And then when Star Wars came along, which was in the 80s, we had the development of the right kind of technology to make Kantrowitz's ideas viable, and nothing has happened. Do you see any laser launch, even tests by anybody to put a spacecraft into Earth orbit using laser energy from the Earth, from our New Mexican deserts here, for instance?
Only with space elevator, with laser launch with Dr. Jordan Kerr. But again, space elevator is down the road, to say the least.
Space elevator is a totally separate technology from the laser launch.
Laser launch on its own, no. They're talking about using laser launch as a way of getting space elevator to work.
Well, but that's kind of, it's almost like building what we used to call what do they call that? Well, it's kind of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Right.
In other words, the two technologies don't necessarily have to go together, but they're radically innovative. They now have enough federal back. I mean, we are flying. Do you know, David, that we are now flying a major 747 as part of the DOD that has a chemical laser system on board that can shoot down missiles thousands of miles away? And this came about because of the Star Wars program. And that level of laser capability where you can punch a hole in a missile, you know, several thousand miles away, is the same energy level required to boil the propellant off from its tanks to generate thrust so you can put it into orbit. In other words, we have the technology, as they used to say in the $6 million man, but nobody is assembling it. What is Elon Musk with his millions doing? He's reinventing the wheel that the Chinese invented several thousand years ago. Why?
You know, Richard, I have always felt that while I don't discount what you're saying at all, I have a sort of a different reason for why things have gotten stymied. And it happened when I read a book by Frank White, who's just a great guy, and the book is called The Overview Effect. I think you've heard me talk about it before. And Frank, at the time when he wrote the original version of The Overview Effect, which has been updated, he had interviewed everybody who had gone to space, be it the visitors and tourists who were on the shuttle during those early programs and the Russian cosmonauts, and that they all reported this phenomenal transformative effect, some more than others, but everyone reported it. They saw the world without borders. They started to realize that their petty politics were a bunch of crap. The Saudi Arabian prince that went up and couldn't tell where his hated Israel was versus Saudi Arabia was sort of in shock. I mean, on and on and on the stories go that are documented in his book. And then it's called The Overview Effect because these people, when they come back to Earth, have a direct influence on at least five or six people who then have an influence on another five or six people, and on and on and on. And I've always thought that if there ever was a reason to keep the general public away from space, it would be to prevent the overview effect from reaching through the masses of populations around the world, because you know what? People wouldn't tolerate government as usual and the crap that governments do if they had access to space and experienced that transformative a thing. And I think enough people in the space program know that it exists and know that enlightenment, to sort of use a corny word maybe, is a real threat to the status quo and their power. And the last thing they want is Joe and Mary six-pack getting up there and being transformed with the overview effect. I mean, my God, what are we going to do when we see we have no borders with Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, Canada? I mean, are we going to start to see the world as spaceship Earth, which we really are, and maybe make a different level of decision-making and candidate-making? Bill Nelson, when he went up, who was a congressman at the time, said a trip to space should be a requirement for anyone who runs for public office.
Have you talked with Bill Nelson?
No, I would love to have him on the show.
It sounds to me like he would be the perfect guy to have on as a guest for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is he came within a whisker of dying on the shuttle, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
And people might not know what we're talking about, so maybe you want to tell them.
If I can get Bill Nelson on, I'd like to save it for let him tell the story.
That was the flight prior to Challenger, and the same problems that Challenger experienced catastrophically
happened on his flight.
Happened on his flight, and they came within seconds of the same catastrophe.
Right.
Which they only found out in hindsight. So Senator Nelson has a unique perspective. He's the guy who survived to live to tell the tale. And he has been an arch supporter of really radical space moves in the Congress. He's actually talked about going to Mars because of the possibility of life there, of big life there, which I find really interesting. It's like, what briefings, Senator, have you been privy to? So it would be really cool if you could get him on. But the reason that you cite that maybe there has not been the enthusiastic embracing of the private enterprise side of getting us into space like there was with the railroads and the airlines, even if I disagree, which I don't in part, as to the motivation, the bottom line, David, is the same.
The result, the outcome is the same, absolutely.
With a conspiracy, even if it isn't an overt conspiracy, it's kind of a gentleman's agreement that we'll keep this an exclusive club, because if we don't keep it an exclusive club, it will not bode well for us who are on the inside.
Absolutely.
If that's going on, it's as pernicious as the reasons that I think it might be going on.
Totally the same. It's evil, and it's a real slap to humanity. You know, I had the surprise guest of 2005 on my show was the science writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, Key Davidson.
Oh, I've known Key for years, yeah.
And, you know, and
great reporter.
The reason he was the surprise guest is he laid it out as to why he has been a burned-out L5er and why he thinks alt space is, for the most part, BS. He has a junk file on his computer labeled NASA. You know, he said, look, you know, there's a lot of important things in this world, and all of what the space program promised us it could address for humanity and making the world a better place, it doesn't do anything but enrich a few aerospace contractors on cost-plus contracts, and it enriches, you know, a couple of congressmen and senators in voter-rich states where they have NASA, you know, job centers. He says this is nonsense.
And the question, David, is why has the vast majority of the community allowed this to go on?
Well,
decade after decade after decade.
Yeah, he didn't address that. He just said, look, if you want to reach people like me, then this is really easy. Show us that the space program is for real and it can do and fulfill what we have all been led to believe the space program could do for humanity, not just for the contractors. And otherwise, I don't want your rhetoric, I don't want your crap, I don't want your excuses, I don't want your test flights, I don't want any of that. Just show me. And he was the surprise guest of the year, and I included him in a chapter in a book I'm writing on how you may, in a chapter of a book that someone else is doing. My chapter is called Making Space a Popular Goal. And the chapter just went to the book's main editor. It'll soon be published by Apogee. And Kai and I ended up in a complete dialogue off the air, and I used a lot of his information in the book. But yeah, whatever the reason, be it your version of happenings or the overview effect that I sort of lean to, the outcome is the same, and we are being kept out of space, and the general public is not buying into any of the programming and the rhetoric and jumping on the board of alt space, even though they like space. They get turned on by it. They're not buying into it.
Well, until I go back, you know, I sound like a broken record, but until someone, you know, with the level of genius and acumen that exists in the alt space community sits down with a blank piece of paper and basically tries to figure out what has kept us out of space, what active force is working day and night to keep us down on the farm, I don't see this changing, David.
Maybe this is a
Musk, Zeppert, or Branson's notwithstanding.
Maybe this will be my next conference academic paper.
Well, I think it's way overdue, and obviously if you were to do that, I could put you in touch with some interesting people that could provide, you know, pieces of the puzzle. Because if you, for instance, years ago, I was friends with the so-called futurist community.
Right.
You know, which developed in the 1970s, people like Ted Gordon and others. And my friend G. Harry Stein, who
is gone now, of course.
This program,
yeah.
May not recognize the name. He was one of the alternate space pioneers.
Absolutely, a great guy.
And in fact, I was able to bring him. One of my small achievements was to bring him into CBS as an actual consultant on the Apollo 11 lunar landing, which I'm forever grateful I was able to do, because he really deserved to be, you know, have a front row seat and to have some policy input to how we covered the most extraordinary, you know, benchmark in human history, which was the first time men set foot on another celestial body in our current history. And we all thought things would just, I mean, I remember walking around, and I'm kind of rambling because this is a free association thing, and it's the middle of the morning, not the middle of the night. So I remember I invited Robert Heinlein to be a guest as part of CBS News coverage of Apollo 11. And I was astonished that I had to really work hard to sell Robert Heinlein to the network. Now, you may say, and people in the audience may say, well, good God, the Dean of American Science Fiction, the guy who wrote the book on how to go to the moon and, you know, to live there, and, you know, he did a whole bunch of extraordinary novels that had to do with the occupation of space and the inheritance of space and all that. How could you possibly have a hard sell to get Robert Heinlein as one of the key guests? And the answer was that none of the people who were covering space at the network level apparently had ever read any of the literature that I had grown up with, which included Isaac Asimov and Bob Heinlein and Arthur Clarke and, you know, Ted Sturgeon and Fred Pohl. And, you know, they had no idea. When I said Dean of American Science Fiction, I got a blank look from the executive producer of CBS News Special Events. But I persisted, and we ultimately wound up, you know, getting Robert on the show to be part of the moment when Neil and Buzz stepped out of the lunar module and walked around the moon. And I remember we were there at the North American Rockwell, which had built the command and service modules for Apollo, in Downey, California. And we had the huge hangar doors open. We were looking out over the ocean on the Pacific coast that night. And on a black and white monitor on one part of the hangar floor, there was this picture of Neil and Buzz cavorting around in those ghostly, you know, very archaic Vidicon views that were being beamed down to Earth with that little stupid black and white TV camera that was so unstate of the art. And out the hangar door, over the glass, we could see the moon. We could see the crescent moon, David, live in the sky. And we had those two worlds. Had all of myself, Robert Heinlein, the man who had, you know, certainly inspired me to be there that particular night, going back, you know, year after year after year. And a lot of the other engineers and scientists who were working on Apollo had been inspired by, you know, Robert's stories. And we were able to talk about what this all meant. And he said, you know, Dick, he said, from tonight on, the human race is going to mark time differently. He said, this is the year one. day one, year one of mankind's new era. And I look back on that night, and I look back on our coverage, and I look back on those words, which, by the way, are on the Enterprise Mission website. I've actually put up a page on this little experience. And I think to myself, Robert, because, of course, Robert and Virginia are now gone, I said to myself, Robert, whatever happened? How come we, all of us who believe the dream, all of us that absolutely know in our heart of hearts that without embracing space, mankind on this planet is doomed? And that is not an overstatement. Just look at CNN, look at the headlines, look at what's going on in the Middle East, look at the oil scenario, look at Iraq, look at the Chinese, look at Iran, look at North Korea, look at where we are vis-a-vis where we could be if we had embraced that vision 30, 40 years ago and had an active, participatory, vibrant extension of civilization in near-Earth orbit, in cislunar space, on the moon, reaching outward to the outer parts of the solar system. And it didn't happen. And the fact that it didn't happen may have doomed mankind. And you got to go back and ask the question, David, why hasn't it happened? And why are the same people saying the same thing? Oh, it's going to happen tomorrow. Just as soon as we get this rocket thing, you know, fixed, we can make it happen tomorrow. It ain't going to happen. You know, there used to be a definition, a functional definition of insanity, which is if you keep doing the same old thing and expecting a different result, you're basically nuts. We've been doing the same old thing for the last 30 years and expecting a different result, and we're collectively nuts. This is not the way we're going to inherit space.
Absolutely. Richard, you've been going straight without a break for an hour. Let's take a short pause. And we'll come right back, and I've got tons of questions that are coming in. I guess I should be kind to the listeners and bring their questions up.
How time flies when you're having fun.
One quick question before the break. Jordan is downstairs listening to the show on the internet, and he says hello to Robin and you, and he wants to know what the latest update is with the movie. Is it moving forward? Is it stymied? Where are you at with that?
This was actually asked on Coast last night. And I'll tell your listeners what I told George's listeners. We're kind of in limbo. We had a deal with RKO, which I really, really loved the idea that we were going to be at RKO, because RKO, you know, as you know, did Citizen Kane. It basically was an activist studio. We were going to really, you know, kick some you-know-what, and RKO self-imploded. And we were basically let go, and we had to try to find another production company or studio. And we have been in that search now for the last couple, 3 years. And so we have a great script. Everybody says it's a super script, but we have no home for it. And that's where it stands.
Okay, well, maybe some space show filmmakers or people connected with that industry will be able to come up with some leads or introductions or ideas. If anybody has that information, email me and I'll be sure to share it with Richard. Stay right where you are, everybody. We're going to take a short 2-minute break and we will be back with Richard C. Hoagland.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back to The Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our special guest today, Richard C. Hoagland. And for all of you who think the show is going to end in about 13 minutes or 15 minutes, guess again, we're going to take it on up to the top of the hour, noon in Pacific time. Richard, I've got to get some of these questions in. So this one is a chat question that was asked in the first 30 seconds of the show, and Greg in Urban, Pennsylvania has been patiently waiting for me to ask you, when are we going to see the conclusion of the Moon with a View Iapetus anomalies on the Enterprise mission site?
Okay, that's a very good question. We've just passed the year anniversary of the Cassini flyby of Iapetus. And for those that don't know what he's talking about, Arthur Clarke and I are very old friends, and of course, I've been a devotee of his works, you know, for most of my life, my reading life, I guess. And then when I joined CBS and he joined CBS as a consultant, we actually met and became good friends, and we've kept in touch over the years, and I have been extraordinarily admiring of his perspicacity, his vision. And in particular, when the Cassini images came out of Iapetus showing this extraordinary little place, I put together a series called Moon with a View, basically harking back to Arthur's vision and asking the question, how in the world did Arthur know that Iapetus was the most extraordinary, amazing place I think we've discovered in the entire solar system before we'd ever sent a spacecraft to get close enough to get us any kind of a decent view? I mean, it really is phenomenal, David. You've got a little place that's, not even 1,000 miles across that has this 12-mile-high wall going completely around the moon, exactly on the equator, 62,000 feet high and something like 12 miles wide. And if you look at the close-ups sent back by the Cassini spacecraft, it is geometric. It is clearly, from those of us who've looked at this data now for decades, it's clearly an artificial structure. Now, the planetary scientists at JPL freak out. You know, they roll their eyes, they have conniptions when I say things like that.
Yeah, it was asked to the one who was on my show, Kevin, and he did, just went light years to refute the argument that the listener brought up using your information.
Well, the problem with their model is they have no model. When you ask any planetary scientist, given we visited so many bodies now all over the solar system with unmanned spacecraft, and we have never seen anything like this. If this was the normal process of forming planets, you'd expect, like ruffles have ridges, you'd expect moons to have ridges all over the place.
Yeah, it'd be repeated someplace.
Exactly. And when you encounter an example of one, a uniqueness, that is when your scientific radar should be turned on to high gear, mixing metaphors badly, and you should ask yourself some really out-of-the-box questions, which, of course, is what we here at Enterprise do. And the answers that we have gleaned and some of the better questions that we now think we should be able to ask prior to the next Cassini flyby, which is, inexplicably They have not planned to go back until September of 2007.
Right, and you heard the response on my show.
Actually, I didn't hear the response. I know all their, you know, excuses.
I told you what, you know, it was their mission planning priority.
It's garbage, you know. In science, when you find something really astonishing, if it's important, you go and find new data before your technology dies. Cassini could die at any moment. Spacecraft in that environment are at peril because it's a very hostile environment. It has radiation. It's got little objects orbiting around. It's got a ring system. There's all kinds of junk in the Saturn system. All it takes is a miscalculation. Remember how JPL couldn't match feet and meters with Mars polar lander?
Yeah, like my math exams.
It was the Mars orbiter.
Right.
And, you know, they basically blew a mission because of an accident. Well, accidents can happen. The fact that you're going to wait after you discover this stunning planetary anomaly, which goes to the heart of, you know, forget my perspective, just go to the heart of how do planets form. A planet with a 12-mile-high ridge all around the equator has got to be telling us something astonishingly important about how planets form. You'd think somebody would be interested and curious enough to want to get more data before the spacecraft craps out.
And of course,
instead, they have put this at the end of the queue. And in the series that the gentleman from Pennsylvania, you know, alluded to, I describe how they could have gone next week back to Iapetus with no problems for the rest of their planned mission, given that they have to go by Titan on every orbit. Titan is being used to slingshot that little spacecraft all around the Saturn system, a basically fuelless billiard ball kind of rendezvous scenario. Since they have prioritized Titan for these observations through 44 close passes, one or two of those passes much sooner than 2007 could have been allocated to take Cassini back out to Iapetus to make a close flyby once or twice at the node so that you didn't have to do a plane change. All of this is, you know, basically computerizable. You know, there's nothing, you know, far out here. There's nothing that can't be done. There's nothing that isn't off the shelf. There's nothing that a can-do NASA, the NASA of old, the NASA, that, for instance, that sent, you know, Apollo 8 to the moon when we had just had one successful mission, Wally Schirra on Apollo 7 in Earth orbit, after we had killed three astronauts on the fire on the pad in 1967 with the Apollo 1 fire, you know, that kind of NASA would have said, oh, my God, we've got to find out right now, in the next 2 months, what is going on with Iapetus, because, of course, Cassini is loaded for bear with all kinds of really cool science instrumentation, which can give us data that we could never have imagined on any other mission. I mean, there is an onboard radar on this spacecraft. Remember that, David?
Yes.
And if you fly very close by, you not only get radiometric data, meaning how the moon radiates into space at radio wavelengths, you also get active pinging, which means you get electrical conductivity. You get all kinds of measurements which can narrow down the models for how do you get this little place generating a 62,000-foot-high wall all around the equator on a place that is literally geometric. I mean, do you know that Iapetus is not a sphere, but it's composed of platonic geometric planes? It has the edges that actually are angled at, I forget what the angle number of degrees is, but go look on the Enterprise Mission website, A Moon with a View, and you'll see the close-ups of the telescopic imagery taken by Cassini in December of last year, and the edge of the moon is actually straight. It has straight edges, David. Natural bodies do not have straight edges that go on for hundreds of miles. So there's something so whacked out and bizarre and exquisite and wonderful, and yet we have an agency, a NASA, a JPL, that are doing exactly the opposite from just natural curiosity and sending a mission back early. And I know what he said, and I don't buy it for an instant. I think we're looking at another moving cover-up. And again, until we, American people, get fed up with this and generate enough capital and enough resources to have our own space program and go out there and look with our own technology, I don't think it's really going to change.
So is Part 7 going to be forthcoming pretty soon, do you think?
I'm waiting for some data and confirmations of some of the things that we proposed in the first six parts. I cannot give you a timetable because the leaks don't occur on a schedule. We've had some conversations where some people are going to provide us with some pretty cool stuff, and I'm frankly waiting to see if they're going to make good on their word.
Okay.
We'll obviously be doing Part 7, and of course that's merely a prelude to the next flyby, which as of now is scheduled for September of 2007.
Well, they don't even think that all of this is a priority, and when I remember when Kevin was talking about it, he says, you know, this group of scientists, their only concern is this priority, this group is this group is that, so we could never get consensus to do a priority to point A or B anyway, and we'd have to reprogram everything, and, you know, the list just goes on and on and on of why it can't be done.
What's happened, David, is that we have bureaucratized the space program, so it's no longer exploration, it's no longer fun, it's no longer finding out new stuff. I mean, look.
It's fiefdoms.
It is fiefdoms. It's the old classic feudal system.
For funding.
It's funding. It's how many papers you can write on things that are very safe, very predictable. I mean, this is why the American people are turning off NASA, because it's like, well, guys, if you're not going to go out and find something really cool and different, why bother? Stay home. The attitude of NASA now is that if anything really rocks the boat, don't publish or don't talk about it. For God's sake, don't go back and get more data, because it simply makes more problems, and that is not the space activity that he, Davidson, and I signed on for 30-some years ago.
And that connects with the American people.
Yeah, because Americans aren't dumb.
Here's another question, and I'm supposed to give you best regards from Hank in Longview, Washington. And he wants to know if you have any opinion on the recent disclosure website and content of Project SERPO, www.serpo.org.
We're looking at this. I discussed this on Coast a couple weeks ago. This is an ostensible claim by intelligence agents, which has been put out on the net.
12 military guys, I think, right?
Yeah, working for the DIA. That from 1965 to 1994, I believe, this government participated clandestinely, secretly, in an exchange program with aliens on another star system. And ostensibly, it is Zeta Reticuli, which is 30-some light years away, and it was done in super secret, and obviously it's an extraordinary claim. And we're simply following the release of information, and we're trying to make sense of what is out there. And I have zero assessment at the moment of credibility, and we're simply watching to see what comes out that is testable. You know, I do believe that technically, given what we have found in our own work, such a claim is not science fiction. It is actually potentially possible. And obviously we could do it a whole other program, that's why I believe that. But in terms of the specifics of this claim, I am a complete agnostic at the moment. I neither believe it nor disbelieve it. I'm simply waiting for more data.
Okay, here is a note from David Jinks at controversialscience.com.
Huh.
I worked with Richard on FACETS, F-A-C-E-T-S project, which got NASA to re-image the face on Mars in 2001. One thing that has perplexed me since that time is the fact that no one has gotten to the moon, specifically the two private lunar ventures, Lunar Corp and Transorbital, appear to have been delayed indefinitely. Lunar Corp had ambitious plans to send live video of Earthrise to our planet in 2000. And was commandeered by NASA some years ago. Transorbital seemed to be done, to be a done deal after winning its battle with the State Department over launch plans, and on and on and on. I don't want to spend the time reading the entire thing. Do you have an update or any news on the company? I do, but do you have any information, Richard?
Not specifically. I would generally answer, David, that if the fix is in, there are powers that want us to stay on this planet, and they'll give us all kinds of false front Western towns to distract us and make us think there's progress, meaning us in the alternate space community, when in fact the game is rigged and we're not going to be allowed out of low Earth orbit come hell or high water, then that is a prediction which is fulfilled by the specific example that he cites in his email. And if you know other specifics, I'm sure that they can evolve into that model, because I don't think, barring a major government like the Chinese, I mean, don't you find it interesting that the Chinese launched their first Taikonaut a couple years ago, successfully in October, and then within days, practically, there is an announcement that the President of the United States is going to make a major space policy announcement, possibly for the anniversary of the
Wright brothers,
Wilbur and Orville flight,
right,
Kitty Hawk, which is then delayed into January, and then we have this marvelous new vision where suddenly we're going back to the moon. I would challenge anybody in this audience who's a space expert, you know, either in the technical side, the business side, the insurance side, whatever expertise, to look at those two events as unconnected. The fact is, this government is concerned that China will go to the moon, and they have a spacecraft system now that, if they wanted to tomorrow, they could certainly go to lunar orbit. It is more capable than the Soyuz was, and the Russians, back before, when I joined CBS back in 1968, we're talking about sending a Soyuz around the moon, which, by the way, got suddenly canceled by the Politburo, and that's another whole interesting discussion as to why Russia, when they were racing us to the moon, suddenly stopped racing. In other words, unless you back off and look at the big systemic problem, why is space not following the normal developmental curves of every other transportation frontier exercise in our history? Going back thousands of years, why is space somehow different? You're never going to get to the answer or come up with a solution to where we can give space access to ordinary people. It's the analysis of the problem, you know, that is the impediment, in my opinion, to why we're making no progress, because nobody realized that the game at a high level has been rigged.
Let me tell David Jinks what I know about these two companies. David Gump and Jim Dunstan, who founded Lunacorp, I know well. Jim has recently been on the show. They could not fund their main business plan, where they were going to do these communication projects with like an amusement park rover real time on the moon. And they have moved on. And most of Lunacorp is stored in Jim Dunstan's basement. And David is now the head of T-Space, which you can look up on the internet and see what they're doing. And they've just recently gotten some government funding out of NASA to do some research and some projects that are part of the Return to the Moon mission. And their focus is elsewhere. And I don't think we'll ever see or hear anything more from Lunacorp. Their probably biggest claim to fame was arranging the Radio Shack TV commercials in space. But they could not fund their program, and I think they've all moved on. Now, Transorbital is a different story, and I haven't had Paul on for a couple of years, and I should get Paul or their CEO on and do a Lunacorp update. What I had known about them was
Transorbital.
Yeah, Transorbital update. They were having serious funding issues. They were going to do a piggyback ride on a Dnieper rocket with an Italian main payload, but they had to fund their mission to be able to do that, and I don't believe their funding was ever locked in. I saw their CEO not too long ago, and they're still operating under the game plan that they can do their transorbital mission, which is as planned, but they have to have the funding to do that, and I think that's their drawback right now, is to get the funding. They have to show a really good, solid business plan and risk mitigation and a return on investment and all of what an investor would want in a business plan. And apparently they're not there yet for whatever reason. I will see if I can get Paul or their CEO to come on the show and do a transorbital update. I don't think there's anything I can get in terms of a Lunacorp update. other than what I know Jim has told me, you know, privately, and I know David is running T-Space, and I don't think they're looking back at Lunacorp anymore.
David, let me break in and ask a question.
Uh-huh.
What was the bottom line number for the transorbital mission?
Oh, wow, I don't remember what it was, but I remember Paul Blasé was last on the show December of probably 2004. He was in Moscow, and they had just launched a dummy payload on a Dnieper to test what transorbital could do. And I don't remember what his dollar amount was, but when I asked him if their funding was secure and what they were doing, he was very evasive about it, and he says they're making good progress with it. It was certainly a doable amount of money. I've never seen their business plan. So were I an investor and I were evaluating their business plan, I can't tell you if it makes sense from a risk business venture type capital type of investment.
All right. We have never lived in history before where there were more millionaires lying around than there are now. The whole dot-com revolution, the whole internet thing, you know, before the crash, even after the crash, there is an awful lot of people who made an awful lot of money out of Silicon Valley and who basically still have it. My question is, in all those people who grew up on Star Trek and Star Wars, if they were given the opportunity and basically told, look, you may lose all the money you invested in. You know, you put $1 million here, you put $5 million there, you may lose it. These are people who can afford to lose that kind of money. Why is it so difficult to get pioneers who are willing to risk pie in the sky to become a part of history, people who have never, ever done this before?
I can tell you, without specifically addressing Transorbital, because I've not seen their plan. And I know a lot of these people.
It's a larger question, David.
Right. The issue they have in the business community is the quality of management, the quality of the business plan, and how does it stack up as a risk investment. And they're not willing to throw their money down a sewer. They will take the risk, and they will walk away from the loss, and they will be fine about that. But they won't invest it with crap management and a bogus business plan.
So,
and this is what I yell about.
Let me interrupt.
Okay.
Why hasn't there been a bona fide set of entrepreneurs with good business plans, good expertise, good management skills filling this?
Well, there are a few, Richard. Richard, there are a few, but the highest quality ones don't take in outside investors. First of all, they're doing it with their own money.
Okay.
Then you have...
You mean like Elon Musk?
Elon Musk and Virgin and Paul Allen and John Carmack with Armadillo Aerospace. These guys are wealthy enough, and they do it with their own money. Jeff Bezos, for example, Bob Bigelow, they're not taking in you and me as an investor. They don't need to. They don't want to. Although Elon... on my show last time said if Falcon 1 flies, he's opening up for investors, and that is happening sooner than what he had previously said on my show.
Okay.
So we may see Elon going to his Wall Street contacts, and the guy has them, because remember, you know, he did PayPal and all those great computer program things that have made people hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars.
Mm.
So he has the wherewithal to walk into Wall Street and be taken seriously, but he also has an A number one management team and an A number one business plan.
Here's my point, though. Let's use Musk as an example.
Okay.
If Musk really wanted to go down in history, all right,
uh-huh,
he could become the leader that would get a lot of other people to risk their millions because they can afford it. This is what happened in the robber baron era of the 1900s, when the railroads were being built, empires created, cattle barons, you know, the whole thing we've seen in movies a million times over. Why isn't it happening in space? The ideas of space are so tiny compared to the vast canvas we have to play with.
Well, Elon doesn't want to do it because he says, and the guy is a really unique, special guy that is loaded with ethics and integrity, and he says, I'm not going to, you know, have other people lose their money unless I can prove this on my own money. And he's put $100 million plus of his own money up. And if he can prove it on his own money, he's willing to say it's worth taking the risk and then go do it. And I'm sure it'll be a private offering that most of us listening to this show probably won't qualify to invest in, but the millionaires obviously will. You have
let me stop you there.
Okay.
What he's doing is reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, like
all
I said.
All he has to do is buy a few wheels, put together a system, hire a Charlie Hall. Remember Charlie Hall?
Yeah.
All right, for those who don't know who Charlie Hall was, Charlie Hall would have been my pick if back in the Harvest Moon era and we were looking for a project manager. I was looking for a Charlie Hall type. Charlie Hall was the project manager for the Pioneer spacecraft series, which, by the way, are kind of a pet series for me because Eric Burgess and I were the ones to recommend to Carl Sagan that the Pioneers 10 and 11 carry plaques to any intelligent aliens out there, and NASA actually bought the idea and put two plaques on that are heading into the galaxy because of our efforts. Again, this was back in the alternate space pioneering days, and we were trying to look to any area that would get people excited about their involvement in space. But Charlie Hall was a project manager who, with no money and no NASA support, created the most brilliantly successful spacecraft series, unmanned spacecraft series, in NASA's history. He was the kind of guy that you would want helming your project because he would command respect. He could have gotten, you know, 1,500 retired NASA guys that would have done it for the love. Why aren't these entrepreneurs basically saying, okay, I'll provide the money, I'll get the expertise, and we'll do it privately. We won't reinvent the wheel. We'll take the wheels that exist and demonstrate that this can work.
Well, I think if you got Elon alone in an off-the-record place and you said, based on what you've learned and experienced, what would you do differently today, he might be more open to some of what you're saying. But let me take it a step later, or, you know, lower further, because there are alt space companies, if people want to get involved, where they can make an investment, like X-Corp, for example. If they want to contact the company and they like their business plan, and if X-Corp is still taking in additional capital and they like the management, hey, go for it. You can, you know, invest and you let it go. SpaceDev is a publicly traded over-the-counter company in Poway, California. You can get information on that and buy their stock all day long over-the-counter. Rocket Plane, you can probably invest in that if you want to take the risk with it. Millionaires have a track record of having invested over the last 5-8 years in various alternative space companies, and they've been burned. Rotary Rocket, Kelly, Kistler, Pioneer, you know, guys like Tom Clancy, Walt Anderson, God, and let me see if I can think of some of the other multimillionaires, went to the cleaners in these companies and these operations.
And what is the fundamental reason why?
Management and business plans. I mean, this is classic business 101. Management and business plans were out of control. Expenses were outrageous. Business plans and engineering that weren't solid to begin with. Lavishness, wasting money on furniture and ungodly telephone systems. I mean, there is a book that was written, it's called They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, and it's the history of Rotary Rocket and a couple of the other alt space guys that you know, came up at the time of Rotary Rocket. And it talks about their business practices and what they did. And when Gary Hudson was on my show, I asked him about these business practices and stuff, and he said he learned a lot. And you know what he said? He said, it's a private company, it's almost impossible to make money if you have investors, because investors have these unreasonable expectations that you're going to provide them with financial accountability and real financial statements and performance standards. And it's a lot easier to get a government contract and get paid with government money and not have to produce any of this crap.
No, wait.
I'm telling you, it's on my show, Richard.
David, when I was under contract to Goddard, when I had a NASA contract as a sole source contractor, I was required to provide various documents as to the progress of my contract. I mean, they don't just give you that money and say goodbye.
No, but it's much less demanding, apparently, than dealing with investors. I mean, people can go to my archives and hear Gary Hudson from about two or three months ago, and you'll hear him in his exact words say that.
This is true, and I obviously don't disbelieve you. This is telling us something very important, going back to my question, which is what's different now and the time of Lindbergh, when we created the most extraordinary aircraft companies and private transportation of the new frontier of flight in the history of mankind.
Well, I think in the investment community, the world is very different from them because everybody wants really, really short paybacks and phenomenal returns on investment. And investors are very impatient, and they're very litigious. So if you violate accounting standards, if you don't give them the right kind of financial statement, if you take too long, whatever, you're really likely to get hit by all sorts of distractions from shareholders. And that was not the way of the investment world in the days of Lindbergh. This is a criticism of the American investment market in R&D right now across the board, not just with space. But Gary said something else that was really unique on that show. He said he was stunned when T-Space got the contract and the money from NASA, and he was about to recommend to his partners that they just take the money and run. He was so surprised that they actually got the money from NASA in the contract and in the mechanism that NASA was giving it to them. He said on my show, I was thinking we should take the money and run and just get the hell out of Dodge.
What, go to the Bahamas?
Use your own imagination. I mean, I didn't say where were you going to run to.
Well, that's the obvious next question.
But, I mean, I said, hey, Gary, I got to get you to be a guest lecturer in my space management class at North Dakota because you've been in the trenches of what goes on in alternative space management companies. And he said, I'd love to. So.
I mean, dealing with the history of alternate space, I'm old enough and have been in this game long enough to actually have known Gary when he was not the Gary Hudson you now know.
Right.
I remember that we arranged our first meeting. He called me up at CBS, and he wanted me to meet him at the TWA terminal at Kennedy International Airport in the middle of the night. And I always thought that was the most bizarre first meeting for somebody, and he basically in those days we didn't have laptops, so he had a briefcase and he had tons of papers, and we sat there in that, remember the TWA terminal, the swooping
wings, yes,
wings and all that,
uh-huh,
all lined with red. TWA was definitely first cabin in those days. And I remember sitting there having this conversation with this bright pioneer who wanted to become the progenitor of Bob Heinlein, is the man who sold the moon. And one of the out of his briefcase, which I thought was absolutely astonishing and kind of the hallmark of who Gary Hudson really was. I mean, he was basically, I guess he still is, the Renaissance man.
Very much so, yes.
Because he pulled out a script that he had just written and sent off to the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And no one knows this, all right? This engineer, this straight-laced rocket scientist engineer type that you guys all now know, actually had submitted a script to the MTM show for air. And at that time, I was, consider myself a generalist, and even I thought that was a little bit far out for a guy who wanted to go to space privately and create rockets that would take a lot of people. But looking back, I thought, no, it's perfectly appropriate because Gary is the kind of guy that's going to do this. Now, Gary has been working day and night, heart and soul, for the last 30-some years to make this happen. And you can't tell me that in the United States of America, the home of private enterprise and entrepreneurship, home of frontier thinking, he has not had an impossible task of finding fellow visionaries and dreamers with bucks to make his engineering come true. There's something so wrong with this system, David. either at the trivial level that people are just greedy and don't have any long sense of history, or at the maximum level, which is that the government fixes in and no one's being allowed to get where they want to get because they're simply given busy work and they're distracted until they burn themselves out. But something is so wrong, and unless we address that, we're never going to get one private individual off this planet in your or my lifetime.
Well, I urge people to go find the book. It's out of print. It's a couple of years out of print. Called, you know, They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus by Elizabeth Weil, W-E-I-L. And she followed Gary Hudson around with his permission for a couple of years. And she documented the history of Rotary. But the lead investor for Rotary was Walt Anderson, who is a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And Walt put in close to $30 million of one of his investor fund's money. And he didn't require any due diligence or anything. And toward the end, I mean, he didn't know it was coming up on the end, but as it turned out, toward the end, he sent in a business school student to start doing some accounting and auditing of Rotary books because there weren't any reports. The finances weren't coming through. He needed to know for his funds and what his fiduciary responsibility, what was happening with this $30 million. So this student goes into Rotary's office, does his work, you know, does all this auditing and this forensic stuff and whatever he does. And a couple of weeks later, Walt sends Gary a list of requirements before he sends any more money. Among them were legitimate financial statements, you know, tracking what happened to the money, you know, on and on and on. The same stuff that, say, an AT&T or a General Motors or whatever would produce at a stockholders meeting for their investors. And Gary, according to what Elizabeth Weil says in the book, said he couldn't fulfill any of this stuff and he filed for bankruptcy. And that was the end of it. And Walt, in a recent letter to me, I wish I had known this subject was going to come up. I would have the letter at my hand, and I would read you Walt's quote. But he said to the effect, yeah, I drank a lot of Kool-Aid in the days of investing with Rotary Rocket. So, you know, when this is out in the ether, and it is public knowledge among informed and active investor in space people, it's really hard for a small company with marginal management to raise any capital because there's like 20 strikes against them because of all the people that have lost money, that have been burned, and that the community knows about. And then when they see really first-rate businessmen like Elon having so many challenges and problems in launching his first rocket, the Falcon, which is probably close to 2 years behind his target launch date, with all sorts of additional cost and expenditures, they sort of sit back and say, you know, not my money. I learned from the dot-com fiasco. I'm not doing it now. Somebody's got to step up to the plate here and show me a success story. And that is what the financial sophisticated world is waiting for. So again, I haven't seen the business plan of Transorbital. I don't know all of their management team. I don't know what they're able to show for paybacks and returns on investment. I have no clue what their assumptions for their market are or anything like that. But my hunch is they're running into an investment climate that has been soured by well-known problem space investments. And then other companies that are still going don't produce anything. So the investors are sitting there wondering, will we ever see anything 3, 4, 5 years out? And the investor will say, Christ, I can go and invest in a 31 Flavors down the street and get my money back a lot quicker with a really good return. Why do I want to invest in this? And this is what I talk about a lot on the Space Show, is to try to get companies to look at management teams, to look at real legitimate business plans, to figure out how to do something that works in the investment climate, not sort of scams the investment climate. And it is a problem, Richard.
Sticking with conventional rocket technology, you know, Newton's third law.
Right.
How do you see Mike Griffin and his version of the presidential vision for a return to the moon helping the private entrepreneurial space activity.
I think Mike would really like to help this community. I don't know him personally, but I know people who do. But he made a speech once, and you know, it was earlier in the year, and he said he would really like to help this community, but he's also the steward of public money. And as the steward of public money, he's hard-pressed to put sizable amounts of public money in the hands of companies that have inept management and business plans and don't produce anything and don't go anyplace, that he would be crucified for squandering the public's wealth by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So he will give what to NASA is a small amount of money, you know, a couple of million to T-Space, or this to X-Corps, or this to here, but in terms of the kind of money necessary to really, you know, do something big and productive, it's not flowing into, you know, the alternative and the entrepreneurial community.
Okay.
Because he doesn't know who to give it to that can meet up to the specs necessary.
Which goes back to my question, why do we have this surfeit or lack of talent and competent managerial expertise when we're so...
I lost you. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, I lost you for about 5 seconds there.
What I basically said is it goes back to my original question, which is why does this landscape exist? Why, when we're so far down the road of rockets, you know, this is not a new engineering. This is, you know, 100 years old.
Why absolutely.
Why are we continually reinventing the same technology?
Well, and I keep asking this on the air. People, I don't know the answer, but you got to look deeper than the market's not there, the investor problems that I've been talking about. You know, why are the companies the way they are? Where is all the super rich, great talent that could make this happen, that could go into Wall Street, that could do this? Why is it that everything is marginal?
I mean,
I don't know the answer to it.
Do you remember back in the 70s when we were all extraordinarily concerned about the environment?
Yeah.
We were looking forward to the day when global warming would do what it's obviously doing now, increasing environmental... I mean, look at what happened to New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma in the last few days. Look what happened to New Orleans, you know, a few months ago.
Well, and we're...
You know, five Category 5s born in the Gulf of Mexico back-to-back in the space of a few months. We just had a tropical storm, Zeta, you know, a month after the official end of the season. So all of the environmental projections that if we continue to do the same old on Earth, you know, we would wind up really cooking ourselves, appear to be coming true. Well, back in the 70s, some of us were talking about space as an alternative that could save the planet, save humanity, save civilization because of opening access to all those resources. For instance, I'll give you an example. In one little tiny Earth-crossing Apollo asteroid, there is more gold, nickel, platinum, and precious metals that have been mined on Earth from the beginning of the mining industry. All you would need is a system, it could be robotic now, that could basically go out from Earth, rendezvous with that, you know, particular object, either nudge it into a long Earth orbit, which wouldn't take much money, or mine it robotically and bring, you know, the material back, and we're back into the diamond business again. We're back into high-leveraged materials that have high value on Earth. Gold has now gone up to, what, $500 an ounce?
Right. You'd bring gold prices down if you brought a lot of it back here.
You wouldn't bring a lot of it. You'd bring enough of it to make the mission pay and to demonstrate proof of principle for a lot of people that simply would look at the bottom line. They'd look at you making money in space, and they would say, here, I want to get in. That's how the gold rush started. In other words, we don't seem to have anybody who's read any history to know how to trigger the kind of psychological gold rushes which created the West and created the United States. And again, given that we have all these people who've graduated from Wharton Business School or Harvard or whatever, I'm astonished at the lack of imagination of how to do this over not just a few years, but over decades, David.
I can't.
The same dumb, stupid things.
I can't disagree with you. And when you look at the management of all these different alt space companies and stuff, they're not coming for the most part from the Harvards and the Whartons and the MITs. So I don't have an answer for you. Most of the business plans are for, you know, going after the suborbital tourist market. They see that as a market. I've not seen a real business plan for resource extraction that you're talking about. The closest thing I've seen is transorbital, but theirs is really not resource extraction. I can't answer your question. I don't understand why, and I keep saying on the show, we've got to look deeper to understand what's going on, because it can't just all be markets and financing and investment criteria. There's got to be other forces that are working here that should be, you know, somewhat able to be identified.
I mean, how much did the Japanese mission Hayabusa cost?
I don't have the answer to that.
$150 million.
Okay.
A robotic mission to go to an asteroid on the other side of the sun, beyond Mars, to land automatically, collect samples, and bring them back to Earth. All done for $150 million. Now, they have had some problems, mainly because of the long distance and the fact that it took 8 minutes for the signals to get back and to do a diagnosis and analysis. But that technology, that robotic technology, that Japanese robotic technology, married together with an American entrepreneur spirit and the right management, could literally go and do on the moon what we wanted to do in Harvest Moon, and show people that you could make a lot of money, and it would have the whole glitter factor. It would be the talk of a Wall Street. It would be the talk of Hollywood. It would be the talk of Cannes. It would be, you know, the people who are oohing and aahing over Oprah Winfrey and Tom Cruise would have something else to talk about. You'd have people on Rodeo Drive, women showing off their rings made from unique material brought back from the moon, star this, you know, lunar that. You'd have a whole marketing ad buzz that would create an environment where entrepreneurship and private enterprise in space would be exciting and would attract investment, and nobody is doing it.
Well, maybe someone will step up to the plate hearing this show and will put together a real business plan with the contacts to make that happen, because
well,
it could happen.
To me, you've got my number and email, and I will talk to anybody, because, you know, if we keep doing the same old, we're not going to go anywhere.
And it could happen. So, you know, listeners out there, if this catches your fancy, you know, contact me, and let's see. I would love to be part of putting something like that together.
It is so doable now with today's technology.
When I had Red Whitaker on the show, from who does the robotics at Carnegie Mellon and stuff, I mean, this type of robotics is slam dunk. I mean, we're not talking now about inventing such new, expensive prototype type of material. This could be done. I concur with you.
Well, we know the Japanese have done it. And you know, why someone hasn't put together, because of the space fever, I mean, the cultural environment in Japan vis-a-vis space is kind of what it was here in the 1960s, if I'm reading the Japanese, you know, correctly. And it's kind of hard, you know, even with weblogs and English translations, to get a sense for the culture. But there's a tremendous excitement at the grassroots in Japan. And frankly, I'm wondering why we're not seeing some of the government effort spill over into the private sector in Japan, which has imitated, you know, very successfully the American enterprise model, and people do things privately to demonstrate and to make money in space and to bootstrap the frontier. If we keep doing the same thing, nothing's going to happen. Elon Musk, bless his heart, notwithstanding.
Richard, how do you suggest the message go to the Planetary Society, National Space Society, Space Frontier Foundation? I know you're not members of these organizations. But how do you reach the leadership, the membership, to get them to open up to embrace something different? What is your, do you have a suggestion?
Well, I think this show was our first, you know, cut at this problem. You and I created this kind of on the fly a few weeks ago, right?
Yes.
And you had no idea that I'd been involved in a lot of these things. I bet you didn't know that I worked with Jerry O'Neill and created the L5 Society.
I knew you had worked with Jerry because you had mentioned that before, but no, I did not know that you were part of the L5 Society. So you're an L5er.
Well, I was one of the founders of L5. I was one of the first speakers at the Princeton conferences. I was one of the participants of the NASA Ames summer workshops. I brought Jerry into Goddard to do a presentation on the whole space colony concept. And I remember vividly, you know, going back to NASA speak and NASA attitudes. This was in the wake of the most incredibly successful NASA experience in its history, which had been the Apollo 11 landing. And I remember we were in a meeting in, I don't know whether it was the directors or the deputy director's office at Goddard with Jerry. And I made some comment, you know, or asked a question about why NASA wasn't more fully supporting Jerry's, you know, very interesting ideas. And this high-level NASA official looked at me and said, well, you know, Mr. Hoagland, we have to protect the agency's credibility. And I thought, you know, well, what's the point of having credibility if you don't spend it? It's like having political capital, as President Bush said after he won the election. He says, I've got political capital, I'm going to spend it. NASA didn't spend any of its capital in the early days when it could do no wrong. It could have funded all kinds of far-out, cutting-edge, blue-sky ideas. And if only 1 out of 10 of them succeeded, we would be walking on the moons of on Iapetus now. And that's where I fault the federal top-down system, and there has been no bottom-up grassroots system, or from what you tell me, it's all been basically, you know, take the money and run.
Well, that was his comment, but I think the focus has been on things like policy, a regulatory environment, property rights regime, you know, the Commercial Space Launch Amendments Act that got waivers for taking people into space so that you could protect the companies and the investors. The focus has not been like
all this.
Yeah, it's not been what we've been talking about today.
Okay, as long as we're talking about this, we probably should not, you know, leave the program without discussing Sir Richard Branson and his remarkable experiment here in New Mexico.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on that? And then I'll give you a few of mine.
I think if anybody can open a space tourism market and have a safe vehicle and make money at it and do it commercially right, I think it's Sir Richard. And I have whatever his real motivations are or his, you know, private feelings and stuff are, I think he's got the expertise, the talent, the management to make it happen if it can happen.
Do you have feelers out to interview him?
I have feelers out to interview people from Virgin Galactic, not him specifically. So I will probably have someone from Virgin Galactic on the show in the near future.
Okay.
I'd like to get Will Whitehorn. I haven't been able to get to him. I have contacted with his office and his secretary. And I get letters back or emails back saying you'll hear from us shortly, and then you never hear back from them. And,
okay, let me make a recommendation.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you call or email Governor Richardson's office here in New Mexico? Bill Richardson is running for president, even though it's not been announced, for 2008 against Hillary.
Okay.
He made a very remarkable set of statements on December 14th with Branson, when they announced the official New Mexico spaceport.
And I've tried to get people from the spaceport on, and they don't come on the show.
Well, you need to talk to the governor's office, because yeah, he's very accessible. Talk to someone on his staff. If you don't have somebody, I'll maybe find somebody.
No, I'll call the office. That's a good idea.
But I think that would be the quickest route, because politically there's a very sensitive... New Mexico is going to invest $100 million in a $250 million project. Now, New Mexico is a very poor state. It's a gorgeous state. I love living in this state. Wouldn't live anywhere else ever again, but it's very poor. And for the governor to be able to convince the legislature to invest that kind of money means that there have been conversations and assurances behind the scenes that, in fact, the economic investment will pay off. And there are some projections, both on the basis of a University of New Mexico study that I saw a few days ago, as well as a private think tank outside the Beltway in Washington, where they're projecting between now and the next, you know, 5-10 years, something like 3,000 jobs and almost $1 billion of private capital and resources generated from what Branson is going to do here in the state. So this really seems to be from my perspective, all other considerations notwithstanding, the kind of beginning that Bob Heinlein and I were discussing that night when we watched Neil and Buzz walking on the moon, and Branson seems to be the guy who is behind it with his heart, his soul, I don't get the feeling that it's just about money with Richard Branson, and I have a bunch of reasons for saying that. So I think as one dreamer to another, David, you need to get Richard Branson, not his flunkies, not his business people. You need to get the man with the vision. You need to ask him the right questions to see how far his vision really extends and whether it's as big as some of us suspect it might be.
Well, I will work on that, and I will call Governor Richardson's office and see what I can do about the spaceport as well as contacts into Sir Richard. I concur, and I think Space Show listeners should hear from him. Absolutely. Are you still there, or did I lose you?
I'm here.
Okay. Richard, how do you want to conclude it with the listeners? What would be your message for them?
Keep looking up. I think we're at the beginning of what I called many years ago the second age of space, the one that can be real. And I think Branson's effort, of all the efforts I've seen, you know, Musk notwithstanding, I think Branson's is the most realistic for getting ordinary people into something approaching space. You know, suborbital flights are the next best thing. It's a means of access. It's a means of exciting the grassroots in a way that the official programs never excited them because, you know, it's one thing watching Superman walk on the moon. It's another thing to realistically project that someday you or your neighbor or your son could do that or your daughter. So I think Branson is basically got the right angle, and what he needs is the right input and support. And we need to find out how big his vision is, because on Sir Richard Branson's shoulders may lie the future of the human species.
I'll second that completely. And for those listeners who might have an interest in doing something with a rejuvenated Harvest Moon project, contact me. And let's see if there isn't a way we can make a business like that really happen today in 2006.
Would you be interested in that?
Absolutely. I don't know why not, but we could certainly try. Richard, this has been extremely useful, informative, and delightful. And I want to thank you very much for your time. And I suggest everybody go to Richard's website. He hasn't promoted it or talked about it very much, but it's a wealth of information, enterprisemission.com. He has a great blog where he keeps things current, and you can stay current with interesting and challenging and provocative issues that come up in space and space-related matters. And stay tuned, right?
Stay tuned, as ever.
And Space Show listeners, we're doing a program with John Harrington and Sam Dinkin regarding Rocket Plane tomorrow morning and Sam's new business, Space Shot, where you can get a skill game prize and win a ride to space on a rocket plane. So tune into that show, 9:30 a.m. California time. Richard, again, my best to Robin and you. Have a great new year. And we have to do this a lot more often than once every 3 years. I'm telling you.
I think we do. It has been a pleasure, and I wish you all the best. And I have a feeling that there are going to be some changes. I'm sitting here in New Mexico, which is in the catbird seat, and as I said, you know, I think that Branson's ideas are actually going to finally be the beginning of a whole new era, provided we give him the right input.
Absolutely. And you and I, of course, will stay in touch. On behalf of our guest today, Richard C. Hoagland, and myself, thank all of you for tuning in and listening to The Space Show. Goodbye, all.